Hello and welcome to this interview where I'm going to be talking about TV and film and probably a bit of politics. And I'm joined by Nate, aka Mr. H Reviews. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Really appreciate it. One of the first things I wanted to ask you is, in your realm of sort of reviewing TV and films and other things, it's not all you do. You know, there's a few people that do that sort of stuff. I like your stuff. I like Critical Drinker. I like Hills versus Babyface, Nerdrotic, Mauler, these sorts of things. I wonder what people you like, what people you watch or look up to or respect, etc.
Yeah, interesting. As a rule of thumb for reviewing, I don't actually watch anyone that does a similar thing.
Because oh,
I
really? Think, right.
Well, because you can create almost like a subconscious bias towards
sure.
things.
Yeah.
So I try to go in to any actual sort of, you know, fundamental review and things like that completely blind. So I don't actually watch anyone that does what I do, other reviews,
right.
essentially.
Okay.
Because I think you can generate, you know, like an association bias, or I like that person, so blah, blah, blah. But the individuals that you mentioned, I mean, Critical Drinker, for instance, you know, good people. You know, I've interacted with them, collaborated with them, very nice people. But yeah, I try not to actually watch anyone
That's good. Because then it's just, it's genuinely your take on something.
Well, yeah, because I think, you know, the power of the subconscious is often overlooked. You can watch something and subconsciously you pick up on it, and then you end up, you know, repeating that or looking out for it when you do, you say someone's reviewed something before you, you then go watch a movie, and then that's a sort of, you know, you laid the foundation there and then maybe you repeat it.
Yeah.
So to give your audience a true perspective of your opinion, try to not watch anything, essentially.
Right. Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, I have a similar thing with history where, you know, the bulk of my content is usually history themed. And quite often there's sort of the normie view, the narrative, the famous narrative. And then there might be a revisionist view. And you're sort of not obliged to, but it's very easy to fall into one camp or the other.
Yeah.
And so to keep it clean, just your genuine thoughts and feelings, I can imagine, with reviews. Especially when something new comes out, everyone jumps on the thing, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, massively. Well, it's SEO, isn't it? Search engine optimization.
Right.
And people, you know, what people want and sort of hype and the expectation to look forward to something. But I guess it's almost like a form of plagiarism in some way. Subconscious plagiarism.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's jump right in. One of the first things I wanted to ask you is, let's talk a little bit about Disney and Mr. Iger.
Because
I see recently one of your videos was, you know, all about that stuff. And
what an absolute joke. Disney, the once behemoth of family film, turned into not even a political tool, but just this divisive entity now where people are sort of waking up to it. It's almost become tarnished like Bud Light, you know, the Bud Light effect.
Yeah,
Disney are just... What a way to ruin a business.
Yeah.
What a way to ruin a business from multiple angles. I mean, you have their drive and push to enter the streaming wars. So Disney Plus, an infinite black hole of money, never going to break even. They're obviously just, it's a calculated loss. So they write the tax off each year. So the fundamental value gets written off each year. That's the way they're going to make money. But on a subscriber base, the investment, they're never going to make money on that. And they spend $250 million on a series of 6 episodes. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable
that not many people watch.
Yeah, well, exactly. It literally hundreds of thousands. I mean, it's you're in the hundreds of thousands sometimes. It's absurd. And then to top that off, you have all of the divisive political language that they bring into it. You know, we're going to talk about this, and we've got this agenda, which is not so secret anymore. It's just absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
Like the Mulvaney protocols. Yeah, what they're thinking? Obviously, that's not going to work. Obviously, I mean, maybe, do you think it's cynical to say that it is something like someone somewhere are embezzling money, or it's like a deliberate tax thing? You want, like, some giant corporation wants to deliberately lose money for some tax thing that I don't understand. I don't know. It just doesn't make sense, does it? It just doesn't make sense.
Well, you look around at society in general and you go, nothing makes sense right now.
Fair point. Critical
thought is completely out the window. And, you know, we're just divided down these lines of people that you know, subscribe and buy into the nonsense which is perpetuated day to day. And then you have people that question it and go, hold on a minute, this doesn't really make any sense. I mean, Disney famously is funded by BlackRock as well, you know, one of their primary investors for starters. Yeah. DEI is a huge thing, which is, again, not exactly a secret in terms of trying to perpetuate a, you know, an actual change. What recently came out with Disney, which was, I mean, just textbook racism, quite frankly, you look at their hiring practices. And make no mistake, Disney's not unique in this, because it's the same with Amazon. Amazon Prime really actually can produce some good stuff when they just purchase it. So when they purchase it from a production studio, it's quite good. But the same with Amazon Prime, they release their own, I think they called it their DEI playbook. And it's racism, sexism, just in plain sight, you know. Mm. They have, they're incentivized to hire, quite literally, in plain sight, it's written there, they're incentivized to discriminate and hire black-owned businesses, right, for vendors, and women-owned businesses. So they'll literally have people going, hi there, who owns your business? Are they black or are they a woman? And then they're incentivized to go with that person, as opposed to across the board, what's a more appropriate thing? And so this is, you know, this is the industry at large, the movie industry. And it trickles down. So the trickle-down effect, you know, sort of in all of the facets of the business. And whether it comes from the investors or whether it comes from, say, the academy or just the genuine, the general industry at large, I mean, who knows? It's what came first, the chicken or the egg? Mm. But you have the investors that promote it, so they fund the DEI sort of elements. And then you have, say, the academy, right? You look at the how to get even nominated for an Oscar now. I mean, it's absurd. Mm. You have to have X, Y, and Z amount of disabled people on screen or behind the screen. Now, you know, last time I checked, that's not a fundamental, you know, sort of element of filmmaking. Mm. Last time I checked, that wasn't important, but apparently it is now. You know, meritocracy's out the window. It's just nonsense. Yeah, absolute nonsense.
The dolly grip needs to be wheelchair bound.
But that, that is as absurd as it is.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I often think to myself, right, you know, if I was in that position, say if I was unfortunate, you know, if I had a disability or whatever it was, for instance, and I got hired, given the current day society, how, you know, I would question, was I hired simply because of my skin colour? Mm. Was I simply hired because I'm an amputee? Mm. Was I hired because I'm partially deaf? Whatever it was, you know? And I think how demoralising that is.
God,
you know,
be.
We live in a society which consistently demoralises us. Mm. In an effort, they say, to raise us up. I mean, that's absurd, isn't it? That's nonsense.
Yeah, it's sort of...
It's ludicrous.
Yeah, it's sort of obviously divisive.
Yeah.
And like even for like vendors, so like the company that makes the lunches for all the crew or something. Imagine ringing them up and saying, yeah, so your owner, are they black? You know, and I'm not looking for Meghan Markle black.
Yeah.
I want Idris Elba black. I need to be at a glance black. You know,
yeah, black like, as coal, please.
Yeah, yeah, blacker the better.
It's just...
needs to be absolutely sub-Saharan black. I don't want any of this Caribbean.
But that is genuinely what it is. And it's there in plain sight on their website.
Yeah, yeah.
It's there in plain sight on their website. Mm. And I think to my, like, 20 years ago, you wouldn't dream of that being, you know, what it is. And now modern day people are like, yeah, that's fine. No, it's not fine. Practice some critical thought, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
But this comes with a blending of language, right? And the definitional meanings of things just being completely lost. You know, racism, for instance, well, the meaning of that is now so blurred by modern day standards, it can mean anything.
Mm.
It's just, it's ludicrous.
Absolutely
yeah,
racism,
ludicrous.
Just trot out the word. It doesn't mean it. Yeah, absolutely. Also, you know, but Bob Iger, you did a video recently, a few people, you know, Bob Iger, it was, I think the conversation was a few years old, but it only came out sort of fairly recently.
Talking about
was,
the leaked video.
Yeah. And that he was saying, he was sort of, tooting his own trumpet about the fact that they made that Wakanda movie. I've not actually seen it. What's it called? Black Panther.
I've
not actually seen Black Panther. I saw different people's reviews of it and I'm like, yeah, that's fine. I get it. I don't need to.
The film aside, the fact that Bob Iger is like, yeah, well, you know, we're so proud of ourselves because we're like, you didn't end racism, for goodness sake.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You just made a film.
Yeah.
You made a film which was, you know, became, I guess, a moment in time because of how people sort of put it on a massive pedestal. People were afraid to review it negatively, for instance. I mean, that film was by no means perfect. People were giving it 10 out of 10. I mean, it's got awful CGI. It's filmed on massive sound stages. I mean, half of it is intangible nonsense. You know, but if you say that, well, racist. Can't say that. So people were incentivized to review it positively. And then, you know, Disney did all this nonsense where they were, I think they were almost, they were sort of selling tickets to charities or something along those lines to bump up ticket sales. So they were giving tickets away and charities were sort of bumping it up, which is fine. Like, you know, if you want to give tickets away like that, but they were including it in part of their overall gross, which is just nonsense. I mean, that's, you can't do that either, but apparently you can. I think it's good if you, you know, you want to give tickets away, but even the fundamental basis of how they were doing it was racist. They were giving it away to black people. Like, black people must see this movie. And I think Hollywood in general is an incredibly racist institution, if you want to look at it as an institution. To relate it to another movie which came out, which was incredible. And this, you know, I'm sure you'll chime in on this, but Revisionist History, The Woman King.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, The Kingdom of Dahomey. quite literally slavers, you know, individuals which we had to stop. You know, we had to prevent continuing. And they put it on this pedestal as this big moment in time that was really important because they were going against the white man. It's like you're marketing really fundamentally evil people as saviours. That's awful.
Yeah, because the British Empire led the way in 18th century abolitionism.
Yeah.
Made videos on that before if you're interested. Yeah, I mean, it feels like Bob Iger wants to be like one of those 18th century abolitionists or one of those mid-20th century civil rights heroes or something. And he's like the continuation of that.
Yeah.
Bob Iger. Did you see not too long ago when Elon Musk said to people, he said to the camera sort of, you know, don't try and, you know, manipulate me in terms of money.
Go
fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And he said, Bob, he said, do you hear that, Bob? Yeah. He was talking, I think he was, it was Bob Iger. Bob Iger.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Director Bob Iger. So it was at this, I think it was the New York Times or something like that. They do this sort of convention thing where they just get rich people to talk about the industries that they're in. And Bob Iger had just been on stage
and had
been discussing the Twitter X boycott. And then obviously followed up with Elon Musk. And Elon Musk was like, yeah, no, it'll just go under, who cares? And they'll be known as the people that destroyed it. Right. And I think that's great. I think that's fundamentally so fantastic about an individual that has so much wealth that cannot be bought, that cannot be persuaded by anything, you know, just goes off of his own conviction. Now, it's not to put Elon Musk on a pedestal. He's by no means perfect. But in that way, it's brilliant because cannot be, you know, persuaded by anything. Money doesn't buy someone like that. And I love that when people don't bow to the mob. And this is the problem. People have lost their voice. It's the reason why, you know, another comparison to someone that's just got so much wealth, it doesn't matter. J.K. Rowling, happy to keep going on with what she says because she can't be cancelled. You can't cancel someone that doesn't allow it.
Right, yeah, good point, yeah. I feel exactly the same about Musk. I've seen two or three different of his opinions that I absolutely don't agree with.
Yeah.
One or two of his things I think he has failed at, or I think he's wrong. But overall, I'm great. I'm on Team Musk, absolutely, 100%. And there's a way more things he's done and said where it's just like, yes.
Yeah.
Like, he's a champion in a way, in some ways. He's not perfect, but it's great. Stuff like that, like telling Bob Iger literally where to stick it. I mean, it's gold, right? I love it.
Well, it's fantastic. And he was also recently at another, I think it was like a premiere of something, if I remember rightly. And he was palling around with Nelson Peltz. Now, Nelson Peltz is an activist investor. So he's bought up billions worth in Disney stock and he's trying to influence change. He's partnered with the former CFO, Jason Cerulla, if I remember rightly, of Disney, trying to get board seats. And Disney's like, no. They're clinging on to power, And it's well known that the individuals that are on the board are appointed by Bob Iger, for instance. Variety did a pretty big expose on a lot of stuff with Disney. And you know, the board is supposed to hold the CEO to account. They're just pals. And that's why the business doesn't function. And so it was so funny to see Elon Musk palling around with Nelson Peltz. Mm-hmm. And when he was on camera, they were like, well, you know, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, you know, just hanging out with friends. Very, very specific in his wording. He was like, I'm hanging out with friends and considering what businesses to buy. And people were like, oh, hold on a minute. Are you trying to partner with Nelson Peltz? Are you trying to push for board seats on Disney? And, you know, whether that's the case or not, who knows? But he said that very strategically. I think it was 2 days before the recent earnings call that Disney had.
Right.
So there's been a lot of sort of movements behind the scenes. They even announced the Gina Carano lawsuit again a day before. I think it was either a day before or the day of the Disney earnings call.
What? Give me an update on the Gina Carano trial then. What's going on with that? Exactly?
Well, so obviously she said a bunch of things during lockdown, which the media nicely twisted around to fit whatever nonsense narrative they wanted to push at the time. And she was sort of vilified and then fired, unceremoniously fired. But the real sort of clincher with it all is that they stated some categorical untruths publicly. So, you know, you can fire someone between contracts, sure. You could cite
and
social
she's
media.
She's taken them to court or something.
Backed by Elon Musk.
Right, okay.
So
right.
Elon Musk did a great Twitter post to say, hey, look, if you've lost your job because of X, we're going to set up a fund.
Yeah,
and he stood by it.
Again, great, right?
Absolutely fantastic.
So is there an update on that? Does she look like she'll win?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, it's very difficult to argue. I mean, I'm no lawyer, obviously, so I couldn't say on the broader aspect of the lawsuit, but there are some things which become really hard to argue with. But obviously that's law, you know, legalese, you could sort of twist and change it. But they did publicly say things which were untrue, which were defamatory, you know, which he categorically did not do. You can look at the tweets and you can go, well, that didn't happen. You're making it up. So I think on that basis, she'd have a standing, but there's been no further movement on it aside from here's the initial, we filed a lawsuit. But interestingly, she's trying to get her job back, which I think's
odd.
I would want to work with a company which is just infested with, you know, these types of people. I mean, it's a hellhole. It's awful.
Yeah, that is odd.
Mm.
I have to go back and look at how they actually defamed her. Like, claimed that she personally bought MAGA hats for all mass shooters from 2016 onwards or something. I don't know. But,
I think it was something to do with what she said. It was like, you said this. You know, I think it was the comparison. You compared people to this. And she was like, no, I didn't do that, because she didn't. Right. You know? So, yeah.
So to go on from Disney then, a little bit about Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
And Star Wars and stuff.
The never-ending Lucasfilm.
So is Kathleen Kennedy, is she still the head of it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because every now and again, you get stories that Bob's really pissed with Kathleen and she's going to be fired. Sometimes you might see a bit of throwaway article saying she has been fired, and then it's just, no, that didn't actually happen. She's still there. So she's still there to this day.
So, I mean, it's an interesting one with Kathleen Kennedy, isn't it? Because loads of people like to cite her previous production credits, like where she was a producer on Indiana Jones.
You're right,
sure, fine.
Going back to the 80s, right?
Yeah. So she's been around for a while. But very clearly she was managed at that point.
Right.
You know, you then put her in a creative role, and we get the likes of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny.
Mm.
I mean, we have the new Star Wars. We have the Willow series, which completely bombed. Everything that Lucasfilm put, and Lucasfilm doesn't have a lot of IPs.
Right.
You know, as a studio, there's not a lot which they actually own as original intellectual property. So then, you know, subsequently sort of denigrating and destroying every single IP, it's lunacy that she's still there. It doesn't make sense. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, for instance, I mean, that would have lost somewhere in the region, at the bare minimum, $200 million. Actually lost $200 million. You know, the Willow series, I can't remember the budget for that. But, I mean, they canned it. You know, it's not coming back for a season two. It's a complete failure, right? The Star Wars, diminishing returns on Star Wars, you've got merchandise on discount all the time, people having to get rid of merchandise. The only thing that they did have for a while was The Mandalorian. And, you know, that season one was, you know, good. Some people didn't like it. Some people did. But, you know, the majority of people quite liked it. And then they've even started to destroy that. You know, they've started to make it the Bo-Katan, a female Mandalorian show now, sort of twisting it onto someone else as the point of view character. So it's crazy that she's still there. And it's almost as if, I mean, I sort of like to joke that she must have dirt on people. She's been in the industry for so long. She must have dirt on someone. Or such a solid contract that George Lucas left her with as he sold the company that they can't get rid of her. Because from a purely financial perspective, why is she still there?
Yeah, the numbers are astronomical. 100 millionaire, 200 millionaire, a quarter of a billion there. It's like, how does... But I feel like maybe it's just deliberate. Like people like Bob Iger, their actual end game is to destroy Lucasfilm or Disney or whatever. It feels like that is the point.
It does feel like that.
I don't know.
I think what it is trying to enact societal change. Because I rack my head on it from a pure business perspective, you know, supply and demand, right? If there's no demand, don't supply it. Just stop. Like, what are you doing? If you can very clearly see that there's no demand, just stop. Why would you keep going headfirst into this stuff? And I think it must be to do with societal change. It has to be. Because at the end of the day, why would you keep doing it? Because if you're a business, your main fundamental goal as a business is profit. If you're not making profit, you have to change what you're doing as a business. Mm. That would make sense. Right? Unless there's another goal, and if the goal is societal change, then, well, they're trying.
So, like, you know, if that's true, I think it is, probably is, you know, someone like Bob Iger or Kathleen Kennedy, they're not business people. They're not they're not producers. They are political activists.
Yeah.
Then that's the proper description for them then.
Well, again, that video that you referenced with Bob Iger, you know, he was very happy about saying, yeah, well, we shouldn't have sat back. We had to get political. I own that. That was my decision. Okay. Well, then you failed your fiduciary duty to your shareholders, haven't you? Straight away. You have failed.
The cat that got the cream. You had a very good turn of phrase, if I remember rightly. I believe you called him, quote, a smug prick. Perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Well, because...
it's so annoying, right? It's so on top of everything else. It's just like...
But he is, isn't he? So smarmy.
Yeah.
He is the... A lot of people thought he was going to try and run for president, right?
Oh, that's the other way. He might be looking for a political career.
Trying to. And you know what? I can believe it. With the fact that you can tell a lot about how people interact, and it's so manufactured, it's so just fake. You know, he smiles his way through saying things. And you're like, that's really hard to do. You've practiced that, the way you're delivering that dialogue with a massive grin on your face. And what you're saying is just, you know, you're trying to get people to buy into it. It's that sort of psychology of interaction. Mm. You know, you're trying to, it's like you see Kamala Harris nod all the time. And it's that psychology, like, oh yeah, she's saying something to nod to. Yeah, I'll nod along.
Yeah.
Not, most people wouldn't do that. But, you know, there are people that would, of course.
There's loads of things. Quite a lot of politicians. Blair used to do this a lot.
Yeah.
Or go like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's so lame.
Well, oh God, political class are lame in general now. Have been for a while. Goodness me.
One other thing, just going back to Kathleen Kennedy, I think you make a really good point, is that if they're sort of, even if you've got an extremely powerful, influential job within a project, it's different to being the overall head of it. I think in history or in military history, quite often you can get someone that's a brilliant colonel or a brilliant head of a battalion or a regiment or something, or even like a corps commander.
Mm.
They're brilliant. But then you make them the commander in chief. And they've got nothing. You realise they're an empty bag. They're just like...
Yeah.
Or they're worse than nothing. They're actively a detriment.
Well, but what a great example. I mean, that's her through and through.
Right.
You know, she's... Just the projects that she has greenlit. They're making another Rey movie.
Really?
No, they're making a... And they're like, oh, people are so looking forward to it. No. This will be the film... This will be the film that goes down as one of the biggest bombs, I think, for Star Wars in quite some time. Because I think ultimately, you know, you can forgive people for tuning into The Force Awakens, right? We hadn't had Star Wars for a very long period of time. It had come back and, you know, the trailer genuinely looked interesting, right? Like, you think back to the trailer, it was interesting. There was hype. And then because of how they had sort of written those films, it was always, there's an expectation of a payoff. And it was very deliberate. You know, you're constantly wanting a payoff to happen. Like, it's the mystery box, the J.J. Abrams mystery box.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to keep watching it. Mm-hmm. But then it rounded out as an epic failure, monumental failure. Narrative threads just being tossed to one side. Snoke murdered. Boom, done. Spoiler alert.
Mm-hmm.
For a film no one cares about.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Finn, for instance. Jedi powers? No, who cares? Like, all this stuff just gone. All the fun elements which people were, you know, the fan theories were more interesting than the movies themselves. And so, you know, the initial interest in The Force Awakens, you can, sure, makes sense.
That was episode 7, is that right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then the interest right the way through, you know, people wanting to wait to see, although it was diminishing returns, you know, across the years, the films got worse and worse in terms of box office. But people know now, they've had how many years of Star Wars from Lucasfilm. They know what to expect. They know not to get their hopes up. They know that there will be no payoff. And they also know fundamentally that the character of Rey is an empty vessel, a vacuous, just thing on screen, poorly written. So, you know, they're making another Rey film. It's going to be set in the future. Two characters are going to be the main sort of point of view characters. Rey set up a Jedi Academy. And one's going to be a girl, one's going to be a boy, and the girl's got special powers, I'm sure. And, you know, probably be a an allegory for feminism and the patriarchy. She'll have to beat the man that's gone to the dark side, I'm sure. This stuff writes itself. Modern media writes itself.
Yeah,
and it's so boring as a result of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you where I am with Star Wars. Being in my early 40s, the original films were the original episode 4, 5, and 6. Sort of just before my time, but they were still a massive part of my childhood, right? Massive part of my childhood. And for years and years and years there, everyone was waiting for something new, the prequels.
Yeah.
When the prequels came out, they were sort of a bit weird and not really what people were expecting or really wanted. But okay, they were still all right. They weren't, you know, it weren't exactly a slap in the face, perhaps with the exception of Jar Jar Binks, but they were different, but it was like, you know, it wasn't infuriating. Yeah. And then when the sequels came out, I went to the cinema to see episode 7 and was like, okay, this is weird. What's the one where Han Solo dies?
I think that is the one. Is it The Force Away?
Wait,
the thing is, they all blend into one, right, don't they, right? Because they've all got a big super weapon. Yeah. They've all got something to look out for. They're all doing the same thing. Like, they all blend into one. I know it was a planet. I think that might have been that one.
So I watched that one, and then I saw the next one would have been episode 8.
Mm.
And then when episode 9 came out, I haven't seen it to this day.
Ugh.
I haven't seen it. I think Mauler did, or like those EFAP guys did a ridiculously long review of it that's like way longer than the film itself.
Yeah.
And I watched that. Oh. And I was like, that's fine. I think Drinker did a long one as well, or whoever. Watched a few reviews. And I was like, I get it. I don't need to see it. And to this day, I haven't seen it. And then there's a whole bunch of other films. Like, there's one about Boba Fett and stuff, weren't there? And all sorts of other things. I haven't watched any of them. And I'm not going to.
Yeah, well, so those are the things. Those are the series that they made for Disney+.
Right, all sorts of series.
But again, hundreds of millions of dollars on a service which will never, ever make a profit.
And the last thing on that is that a few months ago, Drinker invited me on his stream, and I've only spoke to him 2 or 3 times, so I was like, bit his hand off, oh, yes, please.
Yeah.
And they were reviewing just episode 4 of Ahsoka. You know this Ahsoka thing?
Yeah.
And I was like, I haven't seen episodes 1, 2, and 3. I've got no intention. I will not watch them. But I had to watch episode 4 because it's going to be talked about. And I watched it, and I sort of couldn't believe it, what I'm watching. I sort of couldn't believe it. I'd watched some reviews of the previous ones, so I wasn't in the dark. I knew what was going on and everything. And I'm watching it and I just sort of can't believe it. I haven't watched any more. And what's the latest? There's another series coming out, isn't there, soon? What's it? Another female character.
So there's going to be, what, take your pick. There's going to be another one called The Acolyte.
That's it. That's what I was thinking of.
Which, if you want to talk about sort of Hollywood, created by Leslie Headland.
Who's that?
The former PA of Harvey Weinstein.
Right, yeah.
How on earth does she still have a job?
Yeah.
Like, this person was very clearly around when all this stuff was happening.
Yeah, right. The sex crime.
Very clearly around.
Yeah.
Like, she's the PA. She would have booked the people in. Like, oh, can you
she
just give us the
type
room?
Of madame for the whole thing. Who knows?
But I mean,
allegedly, I'm not saying.
Yeah, don't sue us.
Yeah.
But I mean, have some critical thought about it. How would she not know? She's the PA.
And also, these people, like, all this stuff comes down to, is the writing any good whatsoever, right?
It's me now.
And you know when you listen to a good writer or a novelist in interview, someone like George R. R. Martin or someone, or you look back to an old interview with Tolkien, or even someone like Stephen King, who is an insane wokeist, but a lot of his novels are superb.
Yeah.
Which is a weird, contradictory thing. I don't know how that's possible, but anyway. When they're in interview and you hear them talking, their sort of their natural intelligence or their storytelling ability or just the fact that they're an interesting person comes across. It shines out of them.
Yeah.
That woman, what's her name again?
Leslie Headland.
Leslie. It's like...
You're
a dull, you're a boring idiot of a person.
Just empty vessel.
Yeah.
But I think this is, you know, this comes down to a lot of Hollywood in general is that they pluck writers straight out of university or internships or whatever. These people have never lived. They don't have any life experience to pull from. And, you know, they are byproducts of their degrees, which is, I mean, academia is just a left-wing hellhole at this point in time. It has been for a while, but is even more so now. And they're just, I mean, it's, you know, it's just subversive. They don't have any life experience to pull from. So you're right, like, you know, speaking about other individuals when they talk, writers and things like
but
that.
But that Ryan dude, the guy that wrote some of the sequels, what's his name?
Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, someone like him.
Yeah, like, they just...
This guy?
There's just nothing to these people. Yeah. They don't have... Again, it's just... It's textbook. When someone opens their mouth, when you sort of know what they, you know, how they sort of move and who they talk to and things, you can interpret what they're about to say. And 9 times out of 10, you're right. Mm. Because there's nothing to them. Mm. There's nothing interesting about them. They've not had a life. They've got no experience to pull from. So, you know, they tribalistic mentality. They say the same kind of stuff. They say the same, sing from the same hymn sheet. It's all the same. It's all the same nonsense. Just homogenous. You know, Hollywood writers are homogenous. And it was laughable that they all decided to strike. I'm like, if I was a waiter and I kept dropping, you know, my food on delivery to the customer and losing this restaurant money, like, I wouldn't strike and go, you need to pay me more. You keep losing Hollywood money. Yeah. And then again, you think to yourself, well, clearly that's by design then, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Well, talk about Hollywood in general. Because there's no company called Hollywood. When people talk about Hollywood, it's a coverall sort of umbrella term, but then, you know, sort of bigger than just Disney or just Lucasfilm, sort of the general subversion or the general weirdness of Hollywood in general, or American sort of Californian movie making that we see. One of the things I think is remarkable, really remarkable, is the amount of reboots that are done, the amount of prequels and sequels or just reboots. So one thing I think about that is that there's different times in history, when you look back in history, there's different times when there's just sort of a culture or a civilization is sort of imbued with originality.
Yeah.
I think of maybe sort of the early Renaissance in Florence, or something, or the old kingdom of the Egyptians, and then something like that, or the Victorian period. Most things that come out of those cultures, it's original. Mm. And a lot of it's zany and weird, and like, where did anyone come up with that sort of thing?
Yeah.
And then, but it's so sort of influential that for decades or sometimes centuries afterwards, they're just being copied.
Yeah.
It seems like maybe Hollywood, from post-war, post-World War II, through to maybe the 90s, was largely doing original things, being original. Some of it was weird and flopped. Some of it was pure genius.
Yeah.
And now it seems like there's been a paradigm shift where they're not trying to, they don't want to be original very, very rarely. They're just rebooting things. And of course, the quality, it's like, why are the pyramids hundreds and hundreds of years after the old kingdom pyramids, so much worse? How does that make sense? Wouldn't they get better at it? Right? But no, it degenerates and it gets worse. I just wonder what your thoughts and feelings are on that whole thing.
Well, I think, I completely agree. I mean, I think movie studios are becoming increasingly risk averse. Some of the most well-liked movies of the past, 50 odd years or whatever, have been risk. They've been risked, like Alien, for instance. You know, I enjoy my Alien films. Alien was famously, it was considered like a B movie, a C movie. You know, it was considered whatever, just go get on with it, just go do it. Mm-hmm. But that's part of it, right? So that movie, and Jaws, for instance, Jaws famously didn't have a lot of budget. Things were going wrong all the time. And it's that sort of strife and issues and troubles on set. You know, they create good product. And it's, but when people have to sort of, you know, on the fly, try and improve stuff. And largely when studio executives don't have their hands in the pie all the time, that's when you get better movies. When studio, again, I go back to Alien because it's a great example. So, you know, and say Predator, for instance, these films are good examples because they were original. They stood the test of time, the originals anyway, and they're iconic in their sort of genre. And they, again, were famously tossed to one side, just get on with it. You've got the budget, just go deal with it, right? They had lots of problems. Predator, the original suit for the Predator, Jean-Claude Van Damme. Yeah. I mean, it's just a hilarious situation to go back and look at. It's so funny. But then the byproduct in the end, what culminated, was an incredible movie with an iconic design that has now subsequently been copied because it was incredibly popular. But it's when studio executives realize what they have. When studio executives think what's going to be popular, it tends to fail. It tends to absolutely fail. And so, you know, they're hyper risk averse now, to get more back to the point of reboots and things. So they don't, there is nothing new coming through. Generally speaking, their aim is constantly to make a blockbuster, always to make a blockbuster. Whereas I've been saying for a while, we need more mid-tier films, but the market doesn't allow for mid-tier films. So a mid-tier film would be, I guess, similar to like a Taken, for instance. You know, it was a movie which, not clearly not designed to break $1 billion, right? But it's designed to do well and make some money. But it was always the secondary market that allowed these films to flourish. So if they didn't do incredibly well in the box office, they would then be sold on VHS, DVD, back in the day when VHSs were a thing, you know, Blockbuster, etc., your local, you know, video store. And that's how they'd make their money. Now, studios have a streaming platform. They can't make money off of that.
Right.
They sell it to themselves, I guess, by proxy. And they don't make money. So every single studio is shooting for profit at the theatres, always trying to hit a blockbuster. And you can't. The theatres alone can't survive on that because, my God, how many flops do we have now? It's obscene. And so, you know, they're constantly going back to titles that people know to try to generate that interest, but then they always swap them to something else to try to get a new audience. So they think, for instance, whatever property it is that's been rebooted in the last 10 years, you name it, it'll always be the same structure. They take the property that you love and then they change it. Fundamentally, they change it always, in the effort to generate a new audience for that property. Because they think, wrongly, that they've already got the audiences, the core fan base audience. They've already got that. So they need to get new people as well. And they just fail. Because writers are terrible. They don't know how to write stuff. They don't have life experience. You know, the war's an interesting one. You bring up the war, you know, and whether it's in literature or media alone, it's all the same thing. It's hard times, you know, true strife, these kind of situations generate interesting people and strong people. And we haven't had that. We've had a period now of however long where it's been as good as it possibly can be. Society stagnates on that level.
Right,
it just stagnates into oblivion. And, you know, that might be a controversial statement, but just look around. Everything's awful. Like, it's a true statement. You just have to look at everything. We're living in some of the, what should be some of the best time, but everything's terrible.
Yeah. No, I've heard it called the long peace.
Yeah,
Since 1945,
yeah,
the West, whatever that really means, hasn't had a global total war since 1945. And yeah, it's played out in history many, many, many times. It's not controversial at all to say that a culture or a civilization becomes weak.
Yeah.
If it's not sort of galvanized by a sort of a skull-crushing level conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're not sort of fired in the kiln of conflict, you become weak. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can relate that to everything now. You know, there's the nonsense of, well, we might have to conscript you. It's like, well, good luck, because you've denigrated everyone that was strong. You've denigrated them as bigots. They're not going to fight for you.
Yeah.
You know, as unfortunate as that is, because of course it is, you know, it's England. We should have some sort of pride in it. But what's there to be prideful for? Why would you, you know, people now don't associate England as something to be proud of, so they don't want to fight for it, and good luck getting anyone else, because you've made anyone who isn't strong or typically masculine, you've denigrated them into oblivion, because you've said that masculinity is something which to be loathed.
Yeah, no, sure, I won't go and fight Putin.
No,
the only war worth fighting for me is against the overlords that have destroyed our nation. That's the only
Two-party system.
Well, we're talking about that, though. So to segue, we will go back to TV and movies, but just to segue on to, you don't just talk about, you talk about other things sometimes, like, you know, you did a stuff on, like, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp stuff, for example. Those are some great videos. So do you, just tell me, I mean, do you want to, or do you have aspirations to branch out into, you know, like politics or more broader cultural commentary, or do you see yourself as just mainly doing entertainment stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? So, you know, when you start a channel, for instance, like, you know, I started the channel because back when I was working as a teacher, the trailer is the nerdiest story. Well, it's not really, but I started, you know, I was a teacher, I was doing teaching, and then the trailer dropped for Alien Covenant, and I'm like, yes, this is great. And I had no one to talk to about it.
Right.
Literally no one to talk to, because like in teaching, you know, it's not ultra geeky. So I was like, I'm going to make a video about that. So hyped, so excited. And, you know, I created a channel just to talk about stuff I was very interested in, very, you know, excited about. And over a period of time, because everything has changed and has become divisive and has become politicized, it's difficult not to address those things. You're being purposely ignorant not to address the things. And people go, don't bring politics into it. And you go, I'm not. They did.
Right.
You know, I didn't. They did. You know, you have to address these things because there's an intersection where you've got, you know, characters that cross over with this, their sort of political messaging. You have to address it because it destroys the media and it polarizes. It makes it too divisive for people. So, you know, I mean, I never planned to do YouTube anyway. It was just something I did for fun. And I don't necessarily plan to talk more about sort of political elements and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I also think, unfortunately, we live in a time where people are shouted down far too much.
Mm.
You know, like, people are shouted down far too much. People don't have a voice and opinion. They do, but they're afraid to voice it through being cancelled. So I think, well, if I don't say some of this stuff every now and then, you know, and show people that you, not to say I'm like a, you know, a shining beacon or anything like that, but I think it's important to stand up for what you believe in. Say stuff that you believe, you know, talk about it. So I tweet a lot more now, and I'm sort of, you know, my sort of political commentary is more on Twitter, more sort of philosophical things, trying to, you know, impart whatever good philosophy on people that you can, I guess. Because I think there's a lot of muddiness out there, like people, masculinity has been muddied, the definition of masculinity has been muddied, co-opted by, you know, people that just think wealth is masculine and, you know, to you know, be misogynistic is masculine, all this kind of stuff.
Mm.
And I think it's nonsense, you know, and academia, you know, I think academia is absurd. I think, yeah, there was once a time, ancient Greece, I always go back to ancient Greece, they fundamentally understood that, you know, a strong mind and a strong body was important. You know, it wasn't just simply, I'm just going to sit down and read a book. Not to say that you have to, you know, have a strong body either, but it's important. These are facets of understanding, in, you know, the sort of fundamental basics of responsibility. You know, you want to earn this, you know, and you speak to a lot of gym goers, for instance. A lot of them have quite conservative-based beliefs, not the conservatives in the UK, obviously. It'd be good if they were conservative. And so I think there's, you know, you can sort of impart, you know, a good change on people by encouraging them to do certain bits and pieces.
Yeah, no, great. God, I couldn't agree with you more. No, absolutely. That's why I sort of do what I do, you know, started off as just wanting to talk about history.
Mm. You can learn a lot by history.
And end up sort of on Twitter or whatever, or making other sorts of videos that sort of are more politicised because, yeah, our sort of whole world has been politicised. And I absolutely share that feeling of I can't live with myself if I don't say something sometimes, you know, right?
It's so important.
It's on me as a man or something, as a human being, to say something.
Yeah.
Right? That's the least I can do, I feel like. I don't know.
Well, it's not much to say something, is it? At the end of the day, what are you going to do? Got shouted down? Oh, who cares? I don't care what you think. Like, who are you? Nothing. You are nothing to me as an individual, you know? Like, during... I think a lot of people were proven, not to get too into it, but I think a lot of people were proven right with their commentary across the last few years with UK and certain bugs floating around. say as much of that as possibly can for whatever. But you know, people were proven right, but people were afraid to speak out. We get sheep mentality, herd mentality, and that goes across into everything. So you know, people vote in the UK just based on parties. Like, no, speak to them. Speak to them. Actually, ask them questions. You know, how are you going to do this? Why? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I actually, you know, lay into people, not lay into them, but pull them apart. You know, actually determine whether they have the critical thought necessary to be in Parliament, for instance. I think that's fundamentally important. You know, we don't have any politicians that have critical thinking. And the only ones that do, that say things, are then they lose the party whip. I mean, what's that then? So you're just training people to be a mouthpiece for a substandard political party. And both of them are the same. It's literally a race to the bottom now. It's a race to who wants to destroy Britain quicker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you step out of line at all, someone like Andrew Bridgen springs to mind. If you step out of line at all, if you don't toe the line, if you don't follow the whip, then you're just out.
Yeah, but before, the political class in the UK, we used to have critical thinkers. We used to have people with charisma. Like, when do we have anyone with charisma now?
Yeah. Doesn't seem like too much to ask, right? Someone that's got the courage of their convictions and the balls to say it, and even a dash of charisma. Yeah. Like, is that too much to ask from an MP?
Apparently it is.
Yeah, absolutely. all right, let's drag it back to entertainment. Didn't Brie Larson get herself fired? What do we know about this?
Brie Larson, what an interesting character. Interesting character. Someone that very clearly has been told to say certain bits and pieces during her career, you know, as they do, because they've got, you know, they are but puppets to their managers and their PR firms. You know, once came out and said, I don't care what a white man thinks about this. It wasn't made for you. So good luck then, because that's the majority of your audience.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're just, that is the majority of the movie-going audience. You need to make films for them. So saying that you don't care, smart business move. So she... pre the Marvels. Go back to the start. So Captain Marvel released, suspect numbers, you know, $1 billion. Yeah, a bit suspect. Well, you know, maybe a tinfoil hat territory, but did it actually make that? I don't know. Well, you know.
They sort of cooked the books on it.
There were definitely reports. There were physical photos of empty theatres saying it was fully booked. And famously, people forget this, but Captain Marvel was the movie which made Rotten Tomatoes change their reviewing,
how they
reviewed things. So, you know, if Disney can influence Rotten Tomatoes on, you know, changing how their whole review site functions, would you really put it past them that they sold a bunch of tickets and no one was there? That's just naivety, isn't it, at the end of the day, to put it past them for that. So, you know, that movie, cross whatever. And then Ms. Marvel, a show about a character famously very unpopular. No one really cares. Has not generated much wealth. They're constantly rebooting it in comics. They released that on Disney Plus. Least watched, I think, off the top of my head, or worst reviewed. One of the two. And then they're like, yep, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make a sequel to that. Right, okay, cool. Excellent. So then The Marvels comes out. Loses bare minimum $200 million, which is actually what Disney have admitted to. That's just what they've admitted to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a $200 million loss. Mm. That's obscene.
Mm.
Absolutely obscene.
It's a crazy number, right? It's just, you can't really get your mind around that. It's easy to say it out loud, but imagine that. Anyway, sorry.
And no one gets fired.
Mm.
No one gets, well, maybe Brie Larson. But yeah, essentially no one gets fired. And now, so pre the Marvels, asking about her future. Oh yeah, very excited. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. And then now the Marvels has come out, asked about her future. Got nothing to say about that. Like, yeah, I bet you don't. Now, obviously, the inference of that is like, well, she's fired. Or at least she's angry.
Right.
And you know what I would be? I don't blame her. I would be angry because if you, again, short-term memory for a lot of people, Kevin Feige touted her as the future of the MCU. She was going to lead the MCU. She was going to be the Iron Man character. Everything hinged around her. And famously, they got people to watch Captain Marvel because they wedged it between Infinity War and Endgame and said there's really important stuff in there to make you understand Endgame.
Right.
There was nothing in there to make you understand Endgame. nothing important at all.
Again, it's hard to not come to the conclusion that it's all very deliberate, calculated even.
Yeah.
Like, you're trying to tank the whole thing then, now.
It has to be. I mean, it has to be. I mean, you look at the demographic breakdown, right, of the general movie-going audience. It is white men. That is the audience, right? But they, you know, society in general says that white men are bad and all this sort of nonsense. And so they're trying to appeal to a broader market, so they make films for a broader market, but no one watches them. And even the films which do come out based, you know, based around trying to appeal to that market, it's white men that watch it the most anyway. You know, Birds of Prey, famously, right? That crappy Harley Quinn film, Birds of Prey.
Right, yeah.
It wasn't men that made it fail. It was women, because they had the demographic breakdown, and it was a majority of men that went to watch it. So it was women. Women don't want to watch other women doing these things. Now, obviously, that's a sweeping generalization, of course. But the facts and statistics bear it out.
Yeah.
You know, women like watching men, funnily enough. They just do.
It's like why women's football, or for our American friends, soccer, women's soccer.
Goodness.
And women's basketball. It's like, yeah, the women don't go to watch it, so not many people go to watch it.
Yeah.
So that's it. Yeah, that's the bottom line.
Because you are appealing to a demographic which isn't interested in your product.
Right.
You know, you're trying to retrofit an interest there.
Yeah.
No one cares.
This idea of having someone like Brie Larson, who in real life, or in interviews anyway, is obnoxious.
Yeah.
Sort of fairly highly obnoxious, not just saying divisive things, but everything about her character, it seems, her delivery is fairly obnoxious. Then you get someone like Rachel Zegler. That's her name, right?
Rachel Zegler. One of the two.
Yeah.
Whatever. I think she takes the crown now.
Yeah.
Based on the most insufferable woman in Hollywood. It was Brie, now it's Rachel.
I saw there was one of the films I can't remember the films where they go into an arena.
Oh, it was The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games.
Yeah. I saw that recently. Did you see it?
Yeah.
I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
Yeah.
Did you know then? So you've seen that. What was the action like? Was it good?
It wasn't a fantastic amount of action.
Was it not?
There was a bit of action.
How was she in the action?
A really long film. It was really long. It was like a film and a half.
Was she good in the action?
No.
Well, she won People's Choice Greatest Action Star for 2023.
That's weird.
That's very weird, isn't
weird.
It? Yeah, weird. Yeah, weird. Beat out John Wick, Keanu Reeves. Beat out Tom Cruise for Mission Impossible.
That is genuinely weird.
That's manufacturing a star, which Hollywood likes to do.
It was over Christmas, and I was taken to the cinema to see it as like a Christmas thing with some family. And so I didn't just decide, I'm going to go to the cinema and watch that. I didn't even know she was in it until I was sitting there watching the film and suddenly she's in it. I was like, okay, I'll give it. And she's not the best actress in the world, but she's not diabolical. She's good enough at acting to carry a movie. So, okay, fine. But Mary Sue, is that the saying?
Yeah. Again, that's Hollywood and writers, isn't it? So the hero's journey is lost now. So they're just good. They just start out, they're good. They're always good. Pick it up instantly.
I don't know why they couldn't cast someone with a disability as well. Fully sub-Saharan. I don't think she's of enough colour.
She's Colombian background, she says.
It's not good enough. I really need a Bantu. Ethnic Bantu, really, we're going to need.
I would agree, you know, considering for Oscars and things.
Might have to cut that bit out. It's spicy. No, fuck it, leave it in. We're starting to have to draw a little bit to close. There's so many other things I'd want to ask you. The new Gladiator. So you talked about Alien. I know you're a big fan of the Alien and the Alien franchise. I love the original Ridley Scott Alien. I love Aliens.
Yeah.
I actually think Alien 3 is pretty damn good. Resurrection, not so much. And then, you know, like, again, in the 90s when I was a kid, everyone was just praying for there to be an Alien versus Predator film.
Yeah.
When it finally happened, I was grown up by that point. When it finally happened, I'm just like, really?
Really?
You've had 20 years, 30 years, whatever it is, to make this, and this is what we get.
Yeah.
So with Gladiator, being a history nerd and a fan of Roman history, absolutely love the age of Marcus Aurelius and Commodus and Lucius Verus and all that stuff. Love the film Gladiator. I think it's great. I think it's one of Ridley Scott's, among his top three, five best films. this new one looks like it's going to be a car crash, right? Like, it looks absurd. Yeah.
Well, the budget's absurd.
All right.
You not heard this?
Yeah, yeah. So you're
$310 million.
How is that possible? Like Brewster's Millions. How are you spending? What are you spending that on? Are you buying like diamond
encrusted
booms?
Chariots?
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's interesting because the first one was made for $103 or $104 million.
Which sounds normal, right? It's like big budget normal.
Back then, that was a lot of money. You know, back then it was a lot of money. But, you know, and they grossed $434 million, but then they also had the secondary markets to rely on as well. And it became a massive cult classic, you know, huge, rightly so, won Oscars as well, I believe. And then if you compare, you know, the $310 million to the $100 back then, My mathematics on inflation are not great, but it wouldn't be that far off, I'm sure, you know, especially if you account for Malta's 35% tax credits that they get. It generates like 110 million or so, 108 million, I think.
He loves shooting in Malta, doesn't he?
Credits, you know.
Yeah, fair to him. Yeah,
that's actually why Lucasfilm comes over here, because we give them I think it's now gone up, but it was 25% of their production budget back.
All right.
We just give them 25% of their production budget.
Okay.
So great, our tax, just cool. Goes to Lucasfilm for their crap project. But yeah, I mean, there's been some really interesting things behind the scenes on that. People were burned, rushed to hospital.
Accidents, weren't there?
Yeah. Some people were very close to, you know, from people that I know in the industry, there were people, they've tried to diet down and say, oh no, it was fine, non-life-threatening. Yeah, there were people who were very close to death for that.
Burn injuries are no joke.
No.
Like
no
minor
joke.
Burns are you live with that for the rest of your life.
It's not really minor. I mean, a burn is a burn. It's pretty full on.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, a scald here and there.
Yeah.
It's not what we're talking about.
A 1 second scald on or something. Kettle. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
It's not like you break your leg and you get better and you forget about it.
Yeah.
It's
your
like,
skin is permanently damaged. But I mean, who wants that movie? It's a movie which no one asked for.
Right.
You know, there is no demand. So why are you supplying it? And the thing is, what's so fascinating about that is, and it's not to say that a movie studio cannot generate a demand. You know, they can obviously generate a demand for a movie. Not everything has to be asked for, because I think that's a go-to that people have is, well, who asked for this? True, that stands up as an argument sometimes. But there are films that come out of nowhere that are well-liked and people go, oh, this is really good. But that's when you've got better people in charge of it and it's a better property.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I saw somewhere on IMDb or somewhere I read or heard that some of it will be set in Elysium, where Maximus is dead, and it sounds
absurd,
ridiculous, and like Russell Crowe's old and fat now, isn't he? I mean, I don't want to be too rude about it.
I don't think he's coming back for it. I don't think.
Oh, is he not even in it?
I don't think he's in it at all.
Okay.
I mean, maybe it'll just be a disembodied voice. Who knows?
Because Ridley Scott did Napoleon recently, and I did a review or two of that in a couple of different places, and ripped it to pieces. Really, it was. The writing was not even laughable, not even so bad that it's comical. It was beyond that. Yeah. I was angry. I was like, and the guy that wrote it, or the main screenwriter anyway, is writing this. So it's going to be crap.
Well, the thing about Hollywood is it's circular, right? So,
who you know.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. But it's not even just that, right? So you have actors that are signed to agencies, but then the actors generate their own production companies. Right, famously. So the agencies then work on behalf of the actors that have their own production companies that are making movies. It's just this circular wash of cash. Because who are the agencies going to go to when all the production houses are owned by certain actors? They have to go to the actors. So it's just this wash. And everyone fails up. No one seems to actually fail and get reprimanded for their terrible work. Like, it's just a failing up. There's a famous Christopher Lee excerpt of an interview where he describes all of this. And he's like, yeah, it's just failing up. People just fail. I mean, he knew it. Crazy. It's absolutely absurd.
And Ridley Scott, groups and things.
And Ridley Scott is not a draw, right? At one point he was. Mm. But if you look at his box office, his movies, I don't think any of them have crossed $500 million, right? So why are you giving this man $310 million when to break even just on production budget, if it's, you know, say you discount the tax credits, you're still looking at over $400 million just to break even.
Hmm. It's not likely, is it?
Not at all. The first one only made $434 million. No, what are you doing?
Yeah. Again, it just feels like it's slippery with Ridley Scott. Like we were saying earlier, that sometimes earlier in a process, or it starts off almost at the pinnacle of something and just degenerates down. I feel like you can say that about Ridley Scott's career. Because, I mean, Napoleon was still, and some many of his other films in more recent years, the cinematography is still there.
He still
looks superb.
Yeah, he's exceptional with visual eye.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you cannot knock Ridley Scott's visual eye. It's exceptional. Yeah. It's so good. Mm. You'll always know, no matter how bad the film is, that it looks great. Mm. It will always look brilliant. But if he's not paired with a good writer... So his best movies are adaptations. The Martian, for instance, pretty much straight textbook adaptation. Great movie. Really, really good. And it's got his great visuals in it. When he's given something to just do, it's great. Alien, he famously didn't write that. His input was very little, actually. Everything was given to him, essentially, like the H.R. Giger coming on board, not his idea. The engineer, not his idea. All these kind of things. He just came in and did it, right? Mm-hmm. So when he's given something to just do, great. Really, really good.
Yeah. Someone I was speaking to about the Napoleon film, they said, I was ridiculing some of the dialogue. There was one bit in it when Napoleon is railing at a British ambassador. And the line is something like, you think you're so great because you've got boats.
We were.
Well, yeah. But for a start, it's not boats, it's ships.
Yeah.
Secondly, you think you're so great because something... It's like that's what an American would... That's an American from the 80s or 90s idiom.
Yeah, modern language.
It's just dumb on a number of levels. Anyway, I picked out that one line of dialogue and they said, well, what actually happens quite often is that the actor is sort of paid so much.
Mm.
And they're so powerful on set that sometimes they just come out of a line or they just change the dialogue on the hoof. And that's it. And you've only got a certain amount of time to do those shots. And if the actor is just, that's what you've got.
Yeah. Yeah, that does happen.
And so they said that maybe, probably, it felt like that was Joaquin Phoenix just ad-libbing, or that was just his line.
Yeah.
And it ends up in the final edit. It's like, it's just a mad process to me. It just seems, and I use the word deliberately, mad, like an insane process that you spend hundreds of millions of pounds. Again, it's easy to say that, but the actual reality of hundreds of millions of dollars, and it boils down to some prima donna actor ad-libbing a line, and it ruins the entire...
Yeah.
It can ruin sort of an entire project. It just seems like an insanity.
Well, the Hollywood in general, the Western world making movies, is absurd. I mean, a great movie that came out recently which just put everyone to shame, Godzilla Minus One, right?
Yeah,
and, you know, people will hear that and sort of go, oh, Godzilla, oh, a bit dumb. No, beautiful film, great commentary, incredibly, narrative's great, just so happens to be Godzilla in it.
Mm.
But it's incredible, absolutely incredible film. Famously made for like $12 million. $12 million.
Mm. Mm.
That's one episode of She-Hulk on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
One episode of She-Hulk.
Mm. It puts it into perspective, doesn't it? It certainly can be done. It's not like there's nobody in the world anymore that can write a good script.
Mm.
No, of course that's not true.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that it's not possible to make a great movie for under $20 million or under $50 million, let's say.
Mm.
That's totally possible.
Massively.
Which again, makes it almost impossible to escape the conclusion that, for me, maybe I'm wrong, but that it's very deliberate.
Well, I think some of it is the industry of Hollywood in general. So, you know, all the strikes, for instance, they strike unions, you know, the unionized, so they're clamping down on things, trying to control everything. And I think that creates a very, you know, you have to film there, you have to use these people, so they can just set the price. And it's just ludicrous. It's insane. You know, the thing about Godzilla Minus One, unfortunately, yeah, their Japanese pay is not great, but that's the industry at large anyway in Japan. So they're able to do a lot with not a lot of money. But you come over to California, whatever, Hollywood, etc., and you can't do a lot with anything. You can't do a lot with a lot of money.
Right. Yeah,
because
yeah,
it's all, well, we'll just set the price. And I mean, it's, but then, you know, having said that, you can do a lot with mid amount of money. So the creator, people lambast the movie for some of its narrative elements. But one thing you can't lambast is the visual effects. It's an $85 million movie and it's exceptional. It looks exceptional. And the way they made that film was locking down every single visual effect before it went, you know, went out. for the VFX company. Yeah, we want this, we want that, blah, blah, blah. No changes at last minute. Gave them enough time to render everything properly, which Marvel famously doesn't do. And Gareth Edwards went to, you know, Southeast Asia and filmed it with like 10 people. He had a crew of like 10 people.
Mm.
You know, you've got crews of hundreds of people, thousands of people now in Hollywood. You don't need that many people. You don't need a T-boy. You don't need a best, like all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. You don't need it.
Mm. Mm.
The whole industry is bloated. Nonsense.
Seems to me some great movies, some of the best movies, in my opinion anyway, that were ever made, it's not about spending tens and tens and tens of millions on special effects. I don't know, like maybe Shawshank Redemption springs to mind or something. Mm. But it's the writing, it's the characters, it's the acting, it's the sort of the human emotions of things. It's not the 80 million we spent on rendering the perfect explosion. It's not like...
Yeah.
You know, like Transformers, for example, seems to me, you know, just a great example of the opposite thing, the absolute opposite thing of something like that.
Just a bombastic pile of nonsense, basically, on screen. Absolutely absurd.
So there was, what's the Madame Web, seems to me. Some people in this, some people have started to try and make the argument that perhaps the West, the woke regime, is sort of trying to put away woke. They've realized that it's not working, it's not selling, and that people are wise to it, and that they're trying to dial down or put away woke. I don't see that.
No,
I don't really see that. I think Madame Web is quite a good example of how that's certainly not happening.
It's not the case. So
they're still full bore ahead.
So I mean, they're not, they haven't put down the woke, absolutely not. You know, they, again, going back to their playbook of DEI, I mean, that alone just goes to show that they're not. All these hiring practices indicates that they're not. That you, to put down the woke and the, you know, that is fundamentally removing the rot at the core of your movie studios. So that's gutting your movie studios. So until they do that, no. There are certain movie studios, actually, which I'll give the benefit of the doubt. Right, Lionsgate, for instance, you know, the Shepherds of the John Wick franchise, for instance, right, Chad Stahelski, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, right? Ballerina, a movie with a female lead, strong female. Sure, I'm not going to say that's woke. I'm not going to go into that with any preconceived notions because they've earned my benefit of the doubt. There are certain studios which earn a benefit of the doubt in the audience, and there are certain studios where you just go, yeah, of course.
Right, yeah. Have you noticed also the phenomenon of somehow it still happens? Somehow a sort of based movie will get made or one that doesn't have any real wokeness in it, and they'll make a sequel and they'll make the sequel extra woke. I mean, like 300 and 302 seem like a good example of that. Like, seems like they made 300 and then the powers that be were like, oh, we've accidentally let one slip through. There's like really strong men that are prepared to sacrifice themselves for the greater good. We best not have that. Let's make a sequel and crowbar in a strong female lead, and that seems to happen quite a lot.
It does, yeah. Don't you think? Yeah, I think that goes back to what I was saying. When a studio has no confidence in something, it's financed, so they just go, just get on with it. And then it's a success because they've not had their muddy fingerprints in it all. And so then they're like, we need to make money on the sequel. Yeah, we'll get involved. Mm. And then that's when all this crap, you know, comes into the picture.
They seem to do it with TV as well, that they make something good and then the second season of it or something, or the third season, it's like, oh, you've got a whole new team of writers and producers now, it's just like a different thing. It's like a completely different thing. Like, that seems to happen a fair bit.
Well, I guess you could make the argument that they realise it's a success, so they then choose to co-opt it for their narrative.
Co-opt, that's perfect, yeah. Just very, very, very deliberate subversion. There's no, it's not that it's difficult to come to that conclusion. No, that is what is happening.
100%. Unequivocally. Absolutely unequivocally. So
it must be really frustrating if you're a writer or a director or something. Mm. And woke is an anathema to you. I.e. you're a normal human being wanting to tell normal human stories.
Yeah.
What else are you going to do? What else can you do? Right.
Well, if that's your industry as well, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, they try to stay in it and almost re-subvert, basically. So I know of a few directors that have moved out of Hollywood because gun crime, you know, it's literally a hellhole. It's awful. And they're like, I've got kids now. Probably should be living here.
In California, you mean? Yeah, right.
Yeah, like, I'm not going to live here. I have to hell with this. And so they've moved out. But, you know, they say themselves that the industry at large is, I mean, it's amazing that they even talk to me, because you'd think that, you know, it's so polar opposite to what the industry wants. But yeah, they're like, no. Like, I've got to keep my head down. Even they admit it. You know, I've got to keep my head down. And you think to yourself, what an awful, you know, awful situation. But that permeates culture in general, you know.
I think what is interesting or nice to see is that people like yourself, people like, say, Nerdrotic or Drinker, right, you guys are sort of the leaders in it.
Mm.
You know, you're on the internet, on YouTube, you're the popular ones.
It's interesting, right? Isn't that?
I mean, really, you know, there are people that do what you guys do that are woke, that just toe the line, that just that just spiel the lie that something like Madame Web is brilliant.
But it's so painfully obvious.
Right.
As well. And
nobody likes them.
All credibility.
Right.
Because people, the beauty of YouTube and new media, so again, what you do here, is so fundamentally important. People buy into you as an individual. They like you. And they know that when they come to you and listen to you, you're not merely a mouthpiece for some other entity behind you. And so that's what's been so great about new media, you know, YouTube, websites, whatever it is. Obviously, you know, YouTube has its own problems for sure, but you can get around that. And that's so great, you know. It's really, really good that there are still voices out there which just go, yeah, this is just how it is. Like, you know, and especially if they can articulate it in a way which is inarguable. Because what's the argument against it? Like, it's so painfully obvious. You can just go, yeah, this is obviously how it is. And people just go, you're just an ist then. Yeah, sure, whatever. Like, it's just nonsense. Like, it's not an argument, is it? It's not a counter-argument at that point.
Yeah, I just wear it as a badge, just fine, move on.
Well, I just think the standards are pretty low then, aren't they? Is that, that's the bar to be an ist and a phobe? Pretty low bar now, to be fair.
Yeah, to be an ist or a phobe is anything other than being completely capitulating.
Yeah.
To a narrative that is insane and makes no logical sense.
I'm just blinkered to everything, so I'm not an ist or a phobe. Cool.
Yeah.
If that's the remit to being this, you know, the sort of, you know, modern day, I don't want it. I'm good. Like, I'll stay with myself. You know, that's good.
God, we're going to have to bring it to a close, but there were so many other things I wanted to ask you about. They're remaking Beetlejuice or Dune. Oh, I really want to talk to you about Dune. Now, let's very quickly do a couple of minutes on Dune. The first Dune novel, I love. Frank Herbert's, the original one. I've read it a number of times. It's one of my favourite sci-fi novels. The old 80s, is it David Lynch?
Yes, David Lynch.
That's weird and I'm not happy with it, but on another level, I still love it. Anyway, I was really worried when I knew they were going to make this, but when I saw the first one, I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I really like the first one.
I've seen a couple of people say it's really boring. Well, you've probably not read the novel then, because if you've read the novel and liked the novel, the first movie is really loyal to the book.
Yeah.
And I really like it. It was slow, but that's fine with me. I like that. It was fine. So I'm looking forward to the second one. I hope they haven't screwed it over too badly or anything. But
they have changed some bits and pieces.
Right.
I haven't seen it myself yet. Lucky guys in the States managed to watch it on some early preview for whatever reason. So I'll be watching it on Saturday. And I'm really looking forward to it. But I have heard from some friends that they have changed some bits and pieces. But I also asked them, look, you know, as a whole, as a monolith, does it stand up? Is it good? And they were like, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, because the first one was great. But I think people's argument for the first one, and goes to what you say, like it's so long. People's argument was it doesn't feel like a complete story. I'm like, because it's not.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's not a complete story. It's the first half of a book.
Yeah, so it's like the first third of it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was watching it, I expected them to abridge it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh no, this is pretty much scene for scene. This is page for page of the novel. And it's not a short novel. It's not massively long, but it's a thick-ish novel.
Mm.
And the point where the film ended, I was like, yeah, that's like a quarter of the way, a third maybe of the way through the novel.
Yeah.
So yeah, they sort of hardly left anything out, it seems. And again, that's fine by me because it's one of my favourite sci-fi novels of all time. But is there talk that maybe there'll be a part three?
Yeah,
is
so they
didn't get to the end of the novel by the end of this second movie.
Well,
they
want to do Dune Messiah, right?
Okay.
So they do this, they sort of potentially greenlight something, conditionally greenlight. Mm. And so what they do on the lead up to a film's release is really hype it up. So they're like, well, you know, we'd love to make the sequel. We'd love to make it. This one's got to do well. You know?
Yeah, it's a tactic.
But that's what they're doing with this. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how well this movie's going to do. The last one did pretty well for the circumstances of its release. You know, Legendary famously almost took Warner Brothers to court because Legendary made the film, not actually okay. Warner Brothers' film. Legendary funded 75%
what
of it.
What did they take them to court for? I've not heard this.
Because Warner Brothers put both Dune and Godzilla vs. Kong on HBO Max. And they were like, sorry, you can't do that. Like, no, you might be the distributor, but you've now nerfed our profit.
Right, okay, right, got it.
But it still made reasonable money. You know, it was released day and date and then also in theatres as well. And it made reasonable money for what it is. It'll be interesting to see how this one does because we're so starved for good content. Visually, it's going to be a masterpiece. I don't doubt it.
Yeah.
And I hope it's good. I really do hope it's good. And I really like the term, you know, the term is a bit nonsense, but high concept sci-fi. I love it. I think it's great. Yeah. It's something to get lost in it. And it's not, you know, it's high concept. It's also grounded. You know, it's based on geographical, geopolitical elements, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I really hope it does well. I'd love to get, you know, more. Give me more. That's fine. Give me more good stuff.
And just the character of Paul Atreides, Muldeeb, whatever you want to call him, is just a great character. It's just a great character. He's not perfect. I don't know. And so far, in the first one anyway, they did it quite well. I thought very, you know, pretty well. In the David Lynch one, it was, you've cast like a 30-year-old dude. It's meant to be like 14 or whatever.
But they did that back then all the time.
But anyway, I've got my fingers crossed for it. And the first one did look great. So I can only imagine that the second one will be the same in those terms.
I mean, I've heard nothing but good things. And the things which are negative are potentially something which you can overlook. So hopefully it's going to be good. Fingers crossed.
All right. Well, fingers crossed. Well, I'm going to have to bring it to an end there. But, Nate, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we'd love to have you back sometime. Because, again, I could just chat about this sort of thing for a few hours, to be quite honest. And it's always a pleasure to talk to someone who knows their stuff inside out. So thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. And then until next time, take care.